You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being broadcast on the 25th of July, 2024, but it's being recorded just about an hour and a half since Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has given his speech to Congress. We're going to talk about two things today. We're going to talk about the Gaza Strip and what Netanyahu is presently standing for. And very importantly, secondly, China's role in the peace process, which is only now emerging as a very significant factor. Remember, Netanyahu, this is not an official visit. This is not a state visit. It was very easy to rationalize the fact that he was not met at the airport by anybody of significance, not even the Secretary of State. And I'm using, as always, a few articles, this one from Stephen Sayuni, however you pronounce that. I'll use a few others, very commonly, Philip Girardi and some others. But just an hour ago, Netanyahu addressed a joint session of Congress, which was widely boycotted, and he didn't say very much. He says, you know, nothing is new here, everything is pretty standard for the Likud party. But as most of you know, he speaks from a position of power. Since the debacle with the current unelected U.S. president, Netanyahu has felt free to back out of the ceasefire deal, which I personally have not dealt with on the show yet. And this is a way where he's counting on Donald Trump. So we'll see the power of the, not the Israeli lobby as such, but the Likud party, and making sure that he gets in. This is really the only powerful entity supporting him. Although even that's iffy. Netanyahu is certainly betting on his election. Although some of you have also noticed, if you read RT, the fix is already starting. I forget the company. It's one that you don't hear about very often, claiming that Harris is ahead of Trump in polls, which is laughably ridiculous. So they're already starting to manipulate that's what polls are. We don't really know how they're collated or collected, the data analyzed, but we know that they're used primarily to manipulate public opinion. Now, there was a meeting scheduled for yesterday, which has been postponed between Biden and Netanyahu. They're claiming COVID-19 for this. But again, I think the Biden people said something like Friday, maybe, if that. But this is something that the Republican Party put together almost at the last minute, Mike Johnson in particular. And it really was a dumb idea for Netanyahu to come here. He just needed to get out for a while. It's probably the worst time he could have picked. The Lebanese situation, Hezbollah, their forces, which have already proven themselves against the Israelis. Then West Bank militancy, since no one's paying attention to the West Bank. Settler violence has been extreme. We've dealt with that here and in the Orthodox nationalists in the past. And even with the Houthis, the Iron Dome is showing itself to be, as with all American military equipment, to be much weaker and less effective than it had been touted in the past. So this is the worst time. You have plenty of people in Israel who are vehemently opposed to him leaving at this time, really before anything has been done as far as hostages or anything else. It's really a way to mend his ego, to go to a place where he dominates utterly, which is not Tel Aviv, but in fact, the U.S. Now, something that's irritating me, one of many things, is that the official number, as of today, of Palestinian deaths is 38,000, which is a laughably low number. Official numbers are usually wrong, almost always wrong. But even those directly killed in warfare, you know, explosions from bombs, missiles, bullets, even that's a low number just from that, but that's what it's supposed to be. It's not all deaths from this war, only deaths that have been from a direct combat situation. Between 60 and 70% are women and children. But the deaths just from the 2006 lockdown, the lockdown that's absolutely barbaric because it includes everything from medical supplies to power. Power, you know, before the war, they had power for about an hour a day. Now, the Lancet, the prestigious medical journal, both Harvard and England, puts the death number, the death toll at 200,000, which makes more sense. They say the total death toll is expected to be large given the intensity of this conflict. Destroyed healthcare infrastructure, severe food shortages, water, shelter, the population's inability to flee to a safe place, the loss of funding to UNRWA, one of the few humanitarian organizations still active on the Strip. In recent conflicts, such indirect deaths range from 3 to 15 times the number of direct deaths. Applying a conservative estimate, 4 indirect deaths to 1 direct death to the 37,396 deaths reported, it is not implausible to estimate that up to 186,000 or even more could be attributed to the current conflict in Gaza. Using the 2022 Gaza Strip population estimate of 2.4 million, this would translate to roughly 7.9% of the total population of the Gaza Strip. Now, that makes a lot more sense than this 38,000 figure that you see on CNN and elsewhere. The only thing Biden has going for him is that he doesn't know where he is or what he's doing, so policies in his name can't really be pinned on him. But if anyone by now doesn't see this Zionist conspiracy, then they're deliberate idiots. Because the weapons transfers, financial transfers, despite blatant out-in-the-open war crimes and atrocities from the IDF, you really only have the evangelicals, these Protestants, to be the only American backing for Tel Aviv, except for America's Jews, and even that, at least in public, is a dwindling number. Before he dropped out of the race, there was a sense that BlackRock was saying peace over there, ceasefire over there would be Biden's ace in the hole for re-election. Not that he needs any real accomplishment to be re-elected. If he wasn't out of it completely, because the fix would have been in, the fix is going to be in for Harris, depending on what happens. But once this, you know, once Netanyahu backed out of it, that was it. They threw in the towel. I think that the neocons and the Republicans still are claiming that the assassination attempt on Trump was an Iranian idea. The argument is ridiculous. The evidence is even more so. But that's just typical of intelligence assessments here, and the fact that they can quote whatever they want and get the result that they want. Unfortunately, the result of a Donald Trump victory, and Netanyahu seems to be banking on this, it will mean a free hand in Gaza from the Israelis, hence the annexation of both occupied territories. And that would be a big negative of an election win. Now, he may do that anyway. He's being pressured to do it by certain factions. Now, the BlackRock administration claimed that there was a ceasefire deal on the 10th or the 11th of July, and that both Hamas and Israel agreed to it. Biden claimed that this was going to bring an end to the war, and it is accepted by the Security Council, G7, most of the planet, and yet, a few days later, Netanyahu pulls out of it. He's done everything in his power to delay any ceasefire talks, whether in Doha or anywhere else. He doesn't even permit his negotiating team to travel anywhere. He's added new demands. And Hamas, typical of them, have agreed to huge concessions. In fact, Hamas has stated that they will dissolve if a legitimate, functional Palestinian state is agreed to. And this is where China comes in. Now, it doesn't surprise you that Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, the finance minister and national security minister, respectively, who said they're going to dissolve what's left of his government if any kind of ceasefire deal is signed. They are, of course, both from the settler movement. Netanyahu's policy seems to be that he has stuck to his policy, or really, you know, the concept that time is more important than the hostages. Even when Netanyahu pulled out of the agreement, that shocked pretty much everybody, either in a positive or negative way. And one of the new demands is that Netanyahu wants an Israeli military presence in two places. Two corridors, the Philadelphia corridor, which is right on the border of Egypt, and Route 749, which was an artificial military road that cuts the Gaza Strip in half. Netanyahu's administration is also claiming, and they've been saying this for a long time, that the female hostages may not survive much longer. Now, they were saying that for a very long time. I don't know why that would be the case now. And this is one of the reasons that the Israeli public seems to be outraged that Netanyahu has left the country without completing any kind of a deal of any kind, especially concerning the Israeli captives. He, today, I think possibly, or yesterday, he visited a few American relatives of some of the hostages, and that didn't go very well. I don't have a lot of details. I don't think anyone does, but he was visibly upset by some of this. Now, when I said before that the Netanyahu-Trump relationship is solid, or that it may not be solid, most of the media is claiming it to be. I mean, Netanyahu is very interested in a Trump victory. Remember, Biden wasn't elected. The evidence for fraud is overwhelming. And during that transitional period after November 2020, Netanyahu very stupidly took a gamble and congratulated Biden before that had been settled. And Donald Trump hasn't forgotten this. And that's extremely important to note. But prior to all of that, when Trump pulled out of the 2015 Iran deal, and this is, you know, back in 2015, before that, Netanyahu attacked Obama on the in his speech to Congress at the time, saying that this was a terrible idea. Keep in mind, you know, Netanyahu's longest serving prime minister of that country. Now, if you recall, a few months ago at least, I revisited the issue of the so-called deal of the century. This was Jared Kushner's plan for a so-called two-state solution in the first Trump administration. And that I attacked it at the time. It's so ridiculous, and it was written in such a hurry that they're claiming that they support a state when in fact it's not a state in any meaningful sense of the term. And that may now be on the table again if Donald Trump enters the White House. I mentioned that this is not going to go away. No one is talking about this but me. Not a whole lot of people talked about it at the time. But keep in mind, when the Zionists say that, well, the Arabs have rejected our proposal for a Palestinian Arab state, understand that that's not what they promoted. I'm not going to get into that again, but that's still Trump's position. And it's almost designed to be rejected. It's almost a purely rhetorical concept that they could say that. But if you remember that talk, I've mentioned it a few times, that the state is not in any way a state. In fact, it's it would just be another Israeli territory. But part of the reason why Netanyahu came here, other than for his ego, is that, remember, most of the settlers were at one time Americans, or, you know, they were born in America, and then they migrated to Israel. And many of the settlers, although I'm sure it makes them feel dirty, they do have organizations connecting them to the evangelicals, which is the main source of non-Jewish support for the Likud party and the settlers, probably on the planet. In fact, Mike Johnson himself, just before he was made speaker, was brought over on a junket and given the propaganda about the settlements in the West Bank. Many Republicans have been there and have been given the official Potemkin Village tour from Tel Aviv. But there's not an international body that has accepted settlements as legal. That, too, I've gone through in great detail. I think it was last year I did it. But that's a huge part of why the evangelicals would like Donald Trump in office. As of a couple of months ago, in mid-May, there was a poll, an Israeli poll, that showed 33% of Israelis support some kind of a two-state solution, although I don't know what that means. It has no reference to the deal of the century, so-called, but... And 32% of Israelis favor Israel annexing the West Bank. So you have this 30-35% on either side, but a two-state solution and annexing the West Bank may be the same thing. And the Trump roadmap to peace is one of the things that show that. So it's not just Netanyahu that's betting on Trump. The settlers are as well. And that would be the displacement of roughly 3 million Palestinian Arabs who live there, permanently making them stateless people. And it's not just betting on Trump to get his policies promoted. Netanyahu is also betting on him to keep himself out of prison. Now, in the UN's review, I came across Philip Girardi, who I've quoted many, many times on this show. And he does a good job making fun of this poor soul, Joe Biden, claiming last Tuesday, I think it was, he said every Jew in the world would be at risk if it weren't for the existence of Israel, which is typical, again, the typical propaganda nonsense, doublespeak, because it's Israeli behavior, Jewish behavior, traditionally, is what's fueled anger against them. This is an international Zionist conspiracy for this to for weapons to continue to be going to Israel, even given their behavior. The only way you can argue in favor of this is through a very awful sense of special pleading. They are getting away with war crimes that are very rarely seen, and they're out in the open. Somehow, the Biden people claim that they have done more for Palestine than anyone else, in or out of the government service. And how he can say that is beyond me, but that's the twisting of perceptions here. And the twisting is based on this myth of perpetual Jewish suffering. And that myth, and this is where things like, you know, Holocaust and the pogroms, and a lot of these mythic events, mythic at their core, anyway, which permits a double standard. This is how those myths actually cost lives. But Girardi also mentions something, a great example of this, that Michael Collins Piper mentioned in his final judgment. He cites Matt Brooks, who spoke at the Republican National Convention, most unfortunately, and he said something equally stupid. He said, President Trump will bring back law and order so that American Jews can once again wear a kippah and walk the streets without fear. They never had any fear here, and certainly not now. The only fear are those who are going to prison for even mentioning this, especially in the European Union. Yes, Netanyahu is a monster and is recognized as a criminal in his own country. If the war in Gaza were to end, and it's not just Girardi who's saying this, he may very well wind up in prison. One of the major crimes, and I've come across this before, and I want to mention it again, the man who founded one of the major film companies in the U.S., Arnon Milchan, was also involved in substantial espionage against the United States. In fact, Milchan and Netanyahu, many years ago, were involved in this together. Milchin is a billionaire. I think he's in poor health living in Europe now. But a lot of his money doesn't just come from the film industry. It also comes from espionage. And it goes to the heart of what Israel is and how they truly think about the United States. And Milchin was involved in getting the material for Israel's nuclear weapons. Michael Collins Piper has made the argument that JFK in the early 1960s learned about this nuclear project from a CIA report, and he told the Israeli delegation that you stop this or you're going to lose American support. And it's from this where Piper makes the argument that the Mossad was behind his murder, as well as his brother, his brother's murder. But after that murder, that program accelerated. In 1965, it obtained the raw material for nuclear weapons from U.S. government-owned enriched weapons-grade uranium from a company in Pennsylvania, and the acronym is NUMEC, founded by Zalman Shapiro, who was also head of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Zionist Organization of America. NUMEC produced enriched uranium for the state, but it was also from its inception part of the Israeli nuclear program. And its chief financier was David Lowenthal. NUMEC would cover the shipment of enriched uranium to Israel, which was not approved at the time, claiming that it was lost. 600 pounds of it. Enough to produce many weapons. And that's where, with the theft of the uranium, Milchin and Netanyahu come into the story. Now, New Regency Films was created by Aaron Milchin. Everyone has seen New Regency on their screens many times. And in November 25th, 2013, in Israeli television, Milchin said that he was in Hollywood as an agent for Israeli intelligence. The point was to gain technology that the U.S., especially in the nuclear area, that the U.S. was not about to send to Israel to create another nuclear power there. And he's very proud of this right now. So it's not just the things like enriched uranium, which Israel could probably do itself, but also the sophisticated trigger for nuclear weapons, the Krytron. It's a gas-filled tube. It's a high-speed switch. And the U.S. government did not permit this as a legitimate export to Israel. Milco is a company that produced them, and the Israeli Military of Defense had a front company, EG&G, between 1979 and 1983. Milchim ended up recruiting Milco's president, Richard Smith, as an agent working for Mossad, and he turned him over to none other than Benjamin Netanyahu, who was his handler. Smythe was the one who was arrested in 1985. He was sentenced to prison, which means that this illegitimate transfer of technology to Israel was well known by the FBI. And of course, nothing has been pursued. Now, of course, both of these men are still alive. There is no statute of limitation on capital crimes like this. But the U.S. has fairly strict laws against nuclear proliferation. And nothing has been stated, despite this now being open information for a long time. Department of Energy was aware of the diversion of enriched uranium from NUMEC. Even in the late 70s, the Department of Energy knows that this was part of a program to obtain a technology, let alone the raw materials for a nuclear device, from Israel. He even had his residency visa restored in 2016 from Secretary of State at the time, who was John Kerry. He hasn't come back to the U.S. In fact, he hasn't gone back to Israel either, because he was part of the Netanyahu bribery scandal there. And Girardi mentioned something that I think a lot of us know, but I always forget about, and that's the Symington Amendment, which was passed many years ago, where the U.S. is forbidden from providing any military aid to a government that has either a secret or an undeclared nuclear weapons program or weapons itself. And that would be the foundation to stop financing the Israelis, but of course, the law is one thing, power is another. Remember, Netanyahu received 29 standing ovations from the U.S. Congress in his prior speech when Obama was president, when he was personally a part of the theft of technology to create their own nuclear weapons many years ago. And that's nothing new. Of course, there's no prosecutions. There's nothing like that that's ever going to happen. Sanctioning Russians or Iranians is no problem. But when it comes to the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, it's a completely different story, let alone someone like Jonathan Pollard, who was arrested and convicted, but in prison he received Israeli citizenship and is now a free man there. It's unfortunate that his parole conditions, Girardi mentions, were eliminated by President Donald Trump. So, of course, these are enemies. And they have always been. You see how Hollywood, JFK, nuclear weapons, Middle Eastern politics, and Israeli control over American society all dovetail in this man, among many others. And this is what, or how, Israel sees the United States. Now, all of that being said, I don't believe the U.S. is any longer a superpower, however you want to define that, but China is. I have an article here from Ahmed Adel, who I've cited before, concerning China's new role as mediator in the Middle East. No one trusts the United States, but many trust China. I first came across this in the Financial Times, that somehow it was new to these guys that China was not neutral on the Palestine issue. They've been pro-Palestine for decades. There's plenty of people who say that this current war is time for the Chinese to gain a tremendous amount of influence in the region. And as the U.S. just becomes less and less credible, someone else is going to fill that void. You've noticed that many of the Arab states haven't nearly been as militant as you would think in stopping the Israelis here. And I say, you know, Turkey included as a non-Arab state, but who is vehemently non-neutral. In 2020, and I did a show on this, China and Iran have solidified, even since then, a very tight economic connection. Back then, it was $400 billion of Chinese investment in Iran's economy in exchange for discounted oil. Remember, it was China that brought Egypt, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE to BRICS and mediated the relationship to America's absolute chagrin between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which was absolutely considered an outrage in Washington because so much of American foreign policy in the region bet on the fact that the Saudi Arabians and the Iranians were opponents. But there was never a time when the Chinese were neutral here. I want to bring something else out concerning the Chinese case. I've made the argument many times, and a book is being finished up, that China is a national socialist state, or a social nationalist state is probably the better way to put it. And their point of view on the Palestine issue proves this without doubt. October of last year, Wang Yi, who was the Chinese foreign minister, meeting in Iran, he said that the root cause of the Palestine-Israel situation is the Palestinian people's right to statehood that has been set aside for a long time. This historic injustice should end as soon as possible. China will continue to stand on the side of peace and support the just cause of the Palestinian people in safeguarding their national rights. Now, this has been China's position for a very long time. And this is just, a week or so after the Hamas attack. It wasn't that long after that that he said to Prince Faisal in Saudi Arabia that Israeli actions are way beyond the scope of self-defense and condemns Israel for its collective punishment of the people of Gaza. But again, collective punishment has been standard Israeli procedure since 1948. There was never a time where China was neutral here. So, what's happening, given the complete defanging of the U.S., failures of the U.S., weakness of the U.S., the total lack of trust in the U.S., China has moved in and not only will secure its economic interests in the area, but will, so it certainly has a better claim to being neutral than anyone else, although it's clearly pro-Arab. The reconciliation of Saudi Arabia and Iran was a big deal. So the point of it all, and this is from Mike Whitney, although I went to the Chinese Foreign Ministry site on this, wasn't that long ago, China brought together 14 Palestinian organizations and created a unity government to rule Gaza when this war ends. Of the 14 factions, Hamas and the PLO, or Fatah, were there. And as I've mentioned in my few months ago, maybe a little bit more than that, my rejection of the conspiracy theory concerning the Hamas invasion, which I clearly rejected, that Hamas and the PLO have signed the Beijing Declaration. The Beijing Declaration is their statement about who is to rule Gaza after the war. Israel doesn't seem to be winning here. Israel's in a war of attrition that it can create, that it can maintain, but probably can't win. So this is a de facto unity government. They'll demand to protect their, well, 1967 borders, for better or for worse, which Israel does not recognize. And this is the closest and probably the best approach of a superpower concerning this war and the future of not just Gaza, but all of the occupying territories. It was a three-day meeting that put the basic law of Palestine as the constitution. This is the Venice Commission of 2009, which, by the way, doesn't mention Israel or Zionism once, and certainly, though, has no connection to the two-state solution from the former Trump administration. So these 14 factions held a reconciliation dialogue under Chinese auspices and signed the Beijing Declaration, the point of it, to end division and strengthen Palestinian unity. And this is the first time anything like this has happened, because now the PLO and Hamas are of one mind. That fact alone is a revolutionary development, that Hamas was willing to, who they clearly haven't been broken, that they're in China, were in China, and came to an agreement with the PLO as a matter of practicality more than anything else. And this, of course, is now official Chinese policy. An independent Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital, based on UN resolutions, although I don't think that's that significant, maintaining territorial integrity, which would include West Bank, parts of Jerusalem, and Gaza. The Constitution being the basic law of Palestine, which, by the way, if you guys haven't read the Venice Commission, it's worth a read. And that this would be the decision-making apparatus. So the way that the Chinese are approaching this now, and, you know, Netanyahu's up in arms. I don't think the Chinese restaurant is going to be a big place now for Jews in New York City anymore. But the three-step approach from the Chinese Foreign Ministry goes like this. Number one, of course, the ceasefire as soon as possible, meaning that humanitarian aid, which has been attacked by Israeli forces, can come in. Then the post-war governance in Gaza. And this is what the Chinese say, on the foundation of Palestine for the Palestinian. So it's on an ethnic basis, a linguistic basis. And then third, for this entity to come within the UN, not because UN matters so much, but because that's a recognition that this is not just some ephemeral thing. This is a real state. So the Palestinians have put their trust in the Chinese, all factions. So if Hamas and the PLO can agree in Beijing, that means something serious is happening here. So this 14-faction meeting is extraordinary. It used to just be Fatah and Hamas, but now you have even more militant groups who have come to an agreement. And there's nothing like this war and high casualties to force that. It's not just a regional matter. of course. Well, the U.S. always said that, but the U.S. can't be trusted. But this document is a feasible blueprint. And the agreement was that the PLO is the sole legitimate representative of all Palestinian nations, including Hamas, Islamic Jihad, so many others. The war, of course, has radicalized people. The PLO, who at one time signed a peace agreement with Tel Aviv, you know, obviously all bets are off now. And then you had diplomatic envoys from Egypt, Algeria, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Russia, and Turkey, too, who all attended the clothing ceremony. At the same time, you had the Ukrainian foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, visiting China, which is sort of a de facto agreement that China may have a role, even though, you know, China's always been pro-Russia. But this is an extraordinary thing. This is the Beijing Declaration has gone farther than anything else in creating a viable roadmap. Whether or not the U.S. opposes it is pretty much irrelevant anymore. And this is something that Donald Trump, as well as his administration, is going to have to take seriously. My big criticism of Donald Trump's presidency, and he may have learned since then, but is his extreme Zionist position and his anti-Chinese position. There's really very little that anyone can do here. The Chinese have been able to connect all Palestinian factions, which we were told, as of maybe a year ago, 2 years ago, were irreconcilable. Well, Hamas and the PLO have been in negotiations for a long time. China just pushed it. And, of course, has the money and has the reach to invest in this state. If you don't remember what I said about the Donald Trump roadmap for Israel-Palestine, please go back to it. I think I called it the deal of the century, which is what he called it. And listen to it. And it's on my Patreon, too. I did an article I uploaded actually not that long ago. So even you have the UN Secretary General, Guterres, welcomed this. After it was signed, there was a spokeswoman, which is, you know, this isn't just some a wish list. This is something that's being taken seriously right now. The very fact that all of these factions can sign a document with that three-step process connected to the Basic Law of Palestine, which is a government model kind of along French lines. I definitely recommend you read it. This is rather extraordinary. Not only that, connecting Palestine with PLO, at least for now, as the sole representative, and connecting that to the Belt and Road Initiative, you know, this is more than an agreement. This is something that can be done very shortly, so long as peace is brought to the place. If you remember my talk about the Trump administration's solution, it was as multinational corporations were going to colonize the West Bank. It said nothing about settlers, but this Chinese declaration is a direct confrontation to that and direct confrontation with the United States and the Israelis, based entirely along ethnic lines. The Western media talked up the Hamas-PLO disagreement, but that's changed. And when you have the money and the diplomatic power and the goodwill that China has built up in North Africa and the Middle East, you have a serious proposal. You know, the AP and Reuters and a few people have tried to find flaws in it. But the Beijing Declaration is something absolutely worthy of respect. And a brand new approach to international relations is being laid out by the Chinese based entirely on ethnicity, and ethnicity being the primary claim for a state. But the unity of the Palestinian mission, so to speak, in the PLO isn't something that was just imposed. It was something that Hamas and all these other groups agreed to. And in the midst of a war like this, in the midst of mass death and starvation, the total destruction of hospitals and everything else, it took a third party like China, not the U.S. or anyone like that. It took a third party like China to hammer out an agreement that now there is a viable option for a Palestinian state, probably for the first time since 1948. with the economic and military foundation. Because the basic law does, you know, the deal of the century has no army. It barely has a police force. But of course, under this plan, the basic law, it has its, you know, it's a regular country like any other. And depending on what happens to Netanyahu, this may actually occur. This may actually work for a while. Anyway, I've gone way over my time. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And I will talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.